Welcome to the Science Podcast for February 17th, 2012. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. This week, the gender breakdown in science and engineering faculty, pinpointing the genetic mutations responsible for disease, and the 2013 budget request for research and development, plus a few stories from our online daily news site.
Also this week, we head to Vancouver, British Columbia for AAAS's annual meeting. Be sure to check out all the extra podcasts that we'll be posting over the weekend by subscribing to our RSS feed or visiting the Science site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
A long-standing issue for female faculty in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics is the leaky pipeline, as in women enter these fields at similar rates to men but tend to depart sooner. Deborah Kaminsky and her co-author used publicly available data on faculty in these subject areas, the so-called STEM disciplines, and found that this disparity isn't as dramatic as she expected. Kaminsky spoke with me about her analysis from her office at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute.
We were interested in the careers of faculty women. We were concerned that women are hired into STEM disciplines and then they leave sooner than men. So all our efforts in hiring more women would have been wasted if we lose them later on in the pipeline. That was really what we were looking for in this study. To do this, we used a unique methodology. We tracked individuals, watched them as they came into the universities, and saw what happened to them.
So to do this, you were looking at quite a lot of data. Can you just tell me about the data sets that you used and the main variables that you were studying?
All right. We looked at 14 different universities. We had 2,966 individuals that we were tracking over time. And what we did to track them was to look in college catalogs. These are publicly available sources. So we sent our students off to these universities, and they went into the archives of the libraries and looked at catalogs from 1990 until 2009 and looked to see when faculty were hired, when they were promoted, and when they left.
So it's all publicly available data.
That's correct.
Interesting. Well, so now let's talk about your results. So you were following both men and women in faculty positions within the STEM fields. So, first off, where did you find that there was parity? You know, in what ways were men and women both sort of on the same ballpark?
Well, we were looking at retention and we were looking at promotion. What we found was that for all disciplines taken together, all of our science and engineering disciplines, the women are staying at the same rates that the men are. They're staying just as long as the men. This is really good news. It means that if we hire them, we're going to be able to keep them. However, what we did find that in one discipline, mathematics, women are leaving much sooner than men. So there's a local problem in one discipline, but not a big, broad problem over all the disciplines.
So that's job retention. What about job promotion?
Promotion rates are comparable for men and women. We were happy to see that women are being promoted from assistant to associate at the same approximate times that men are, and also that women are being promoted to full professor in the same number of years that men are being promoted, years after entering as an assistant professor. We saw that wasn't true in an earlier study that we did looking at women who came before 1990. But women coming after 1990 seem to be prospering much better.
Okay, and now let's talk about the field of mathematics, where men and women do not seem to be retaining their jobs at their same rate. So can you just go into a little bit more detail about that?
Yes, absolutely. In mathematics, what we found is that women were staying for a median time of 4.45 years. So that means that of all the women you hire as assistant professors, 4.5 years later, half of them are gone. Now, men are leaving quickly, too. When we hire men, in 7 1/3 years, half of them are gone. So the mathematicians are just leaving. Now, I want to put this in context because one of the major results of our study is what the median time to exit is. We find that if you hire faculty in science and engineering, what happens is that of all that you hire, half of them are gone 11 years later.
So going back, looking at the big picture here, not specifically at mathematics, the exception, but in general,
if men and women are keeping these positions for roughly the same amount of time and they are being promoted at roughly the same rate, does that mean that we're seeing the same number of men and women in these science and engineering academic positions?
Well, no, because what happens is that we're hiring a smaller percentage of women than we are of men. So, for example, in mechanical engineering, only 10% of the faculty hired are women. So we have fewer women in the pool to begin with, and fewer women are coming into the pipeline. The good news is that if we can get them into academic positions, we can keep them there. But there's a problem earlier in the pipeline. We don't have enough women studying to get doctorates in science and engineering. And some of the women who are studying in science fields, like chemistry and math and comp sci and biology, aren't choosing to be in academic positions at the same rates that men are choosing academic positions.
So in other words, if there were more women applying, then more of them would get jobs, but simply the problem is actually getting them into the applicant pool in the first place?
That's right. That's right. The leaks in the pipeline have occurred earlier in the process. This whole pipeline of drawing women into science and technology and sending them along the path of engineering and science research.
Now, you did something really interesting here, which was you took these data and extrapolated this gender proportion into the future. And so given this calculation, about how long before women will make up about 50% of these science and engineering academic positions?
At the rate we're going, it could be 100 years. There's two lags in this system. One lag is that even if tomorrow we started having 50% women coming in and 50% men coming into these disciplines, because faculty careers are so long, it would take 30 or 40 years before the professoriate would be 50% men and 50% women. All those men that are in these positions would have to retire, and new women would be coming in to fill their places. So there's one lag. That's 30 or 40-year lag. And we're also seeing that we're not hiring at 50% at this point. What we're hiring at is more like 27%. And it hasn't gone up much in the last 10 years. It was 25% and then 27%. Back in the 90s, it was more like 17% and 20%. So we've improved, but the improvement rate is very slow. So if you think about improving, that it will take us maybe 40 or 50 years before we're hiring at 50%, and then another 40 or 50 years before that effect washes through the system,
right,
it's going to be 100 years.
All right. So there's a little bit of good news and a little bit of bad news in this study. So what do you think are the most important messages to take away from this?
Well, I think there's several messages. One thing we haven't talked about yet is the point of view of academic administration. We have a very high rate of leaving. So our retention in academia is low. We lose half our people in 11 years. Our startup packages can be as high as $1.5 million. You're investing in someone at the rate of $1.5 million, and in 11 years, half of them are gone. So this is an economic calculation that universities need to make, and I don't think they've had this number before, this 11-year number, to guide them in their judgment for what they have. And the other thing we see is that it's going to take a very long time at the rate we're going to get women into the science and engineering faculties.
Mm-hmm.
That's another major message. The third message here is in the mathematics discipline, we actually have two problems there that are different from other disciplines. One of the problems is that we're not retaining them as quickly as men. And furthermore, in math, faculty leave even quicker than in other disciplines, like in physics or in chemistry or in electrical engineering. They're leaving quicker in math. The women are leaving quicker than the men. And in mathematics, what we have is that in the pool, there's about 25% women in the PhD pool, but only 20% of them are becoming assistant professors. So when you put that all together, this really points to the need for another study on what's happening in math.
Well, Deborah Kaminsky, thank you so much.
It's been nice talking to you, Karen.
Deborah Kaminsky and co-author Cheryl Geisler write about the gender breakdown in STEM faculty in a report this week. So, you've had your genome sequenced.
you now know the order of the base pairs for all of the DNA in all of your cells. But that information is of little use on its own. The next step is analysis. Which variations from the norm are important and which are not? Daniel MacArthur and colleagues combed through 185 genomes for mutations that appear to disrupt protein-coding genes and identified about 20 of these so-called loss-of-function variants per person. I spoke with him about the implications of these variants on health and differences between individuals.
Basically, what we were interested in here was a particular type of genetic variation known as loss-of-function variants. So these are changes in people's DNA sequence that are expected to completely inactivate protein-coding genes. So, for instance, they might do that by introducing a stop signal right in the middle of them. We were interested in these genes because they're known to be involved in really severe diseases like muscular dystrophy or cystic fibrosis. And what we set out doing in this project was to look at how many of these variants were present in the genomes of ordinary individuals, so typical people. And we were interested in seeing how many of these were present and what effects they might actually have on those individuals' appearance and variation and disease risk.
Well, let's start out with what your team decided a loss-of-function variant would be for this study.
So basically what we were interested in was any type of DNA sequence change that would be expected to really severely disrupt the function of a gene. And there's lots of different types of variation that can do this. So for instance, these range in size from a very small change. You can have a single base change in a gene, just changes one letter of that gene, but it results in a premature stop signal that appears right in the middle of the gene.
Mm-hmm.
In other cases, what we saw is really large deletions of DNA that actually completely remove an entire gene or even a whole set of genes. But we actually came up with ways of looking at most of the different kinds of variation that you would expect to have this kind of serious effect on gene function.
And so for this study, you also used data from the 1,000 Genome Project. Can you tell us more about the project and which sets of genomes you looked at?
Right. The 1,000 Genomes Project is a really large international collaboration. We've been working with scientists from the US, Europe, and China. The goal of the project is to come up with a really complete picture of genetic variation present in people from all over the world. So we're looking at people from different populations in Europe, East Asia, the Middle East, Africa, and other places in the world. So in our project, we were actually looking at what we call the pilot project, and this involved sequencing of 185 people. Some of them have ancestry in Europe. The others came from Japan, from China, and from West Africa.
And you also included a single individual separate from that project.
So one of the genomes that we looked at was what we call our gold standard genome. She's a single anonymous European individual. Her genome has been sequenced to very, very high quality, so we could be really confident about the variants that we saw in her genome. And we also applied a whole set of extra filters to her to make sure that we had the right set of loss-of-function variants.
So you kind of had a big pool of data, and then you also had a single pristine example.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. So I mean, with the 185 individuals, we could have a look at the population distribution of loss-of-function variants, but the data weren't quite as clean. And for this one individual, we had a really nice gold standard that we could look at really closely.
So you used several approaches to validate true loss-of-function variants. What kinds of measures did you take to ensure that these really did affect protein expression?
So we expected in advance these variants would have a really high error rate. So we needed to take a number of different approaches to filter those errors out. And we were thinking, I guess, really in terms of three types of problems that might pop up. Firstly, you could have a mistake in the sequencing. That would mean that the DNA change doesn't actually exist at all. And this is a real concern because this was the pilot project. It was looking at older data from older sequencing technology. So it was a concern that the data wasn't quite as high as it would be these days. The second possibility is that the variants were actually real, but the genes that they were supposed to affect weren't real. The human genome is still not perfectly annotated, although it's getting much better. So there are some genes that are said to exist at a particular region in the genome, and what we found is that when we looked more closely at those genes, there doesn't actually appear to be a protein coding gene at that location, or in some cases it has a different structure to what we thought.
So it wasn't in what you call open reading frame, it was in some interstitial material or
gene? Yeah, that's right. So sometimes it was a stretch of non-protein coding material that had just been assigned as being a protein coding sequence. The third possibility would be that there was a real variant in a real gene, but that it doesn't completely destroy the function of that gene. So, for instance, we saw a number of variants that were really close to the end of a gene. They only wipe out the last 5% or so. That might have an effect in some genes, but in many cases you can remove the last 5% of a gene and it probably doesn't have a huge effect on gene function.
So you threw out some unlikely candidates and you kept some likely candidates. And when you got a high confidence list of these loss of function variants, what themes did you see among them?
Well, the first thing was we settled on a pretty accurate sense of the numbers of these variants that are present in a typical genome. So it turns out that after you've applied all of our filters, the typical human, that gold standard genome that I talked about earlier, she still carries around 100 loss of function variants, with 20 of those affecting both copies of the gene. So in other words, that suggests each of us is probably walking around with around 20 genes completely inactivated. That's a lot less than was being reported in earlier genome sequences. So it turns out there are quite a lot of errors that affect these loss of function variants in published genomes. But it's still a pretty surprising number, I thought. So there's about 20,000 genes in the human genome, and we found that around about 1% of these, so over 200 of them, can be completely knocked out in these humans without causing severe effects on disease.
Did you see any effects of these loss of function variants on phenotypes in your population?
So when we looked at these variants, it looks as though they basically fall into two broad categories. The first ones are the common ones, so these are the ones we see in lots of people, meaning there are, you know, hundreds of people walking around with that gene completely inactivated. As you might expect, there aren't a huge number of these. It's in the low hundreds. And the affected genes tend to look pretty non-essential. So these are less conserved over evolutionary time. They don't tend to interact with as many proteins. And they also seem to have more closely related gene family members. So in other words, it looks as though they have other similar proteins that can take over their function in many cases. So most of these don't look like they're associated with disease. There are a few that were associated with things like blood types or immune responses or drug reactions. Some of them are potentially medically interesting. Mm-hmm. A really big category here is olfactory receptors. A lot of these were knocked out. These are genes that are involved in differentiating people's sense of smell. I think these are interesting in the sense that they might play a role in whether you or I can smell different things, but they're probably not medically relevant.
And so that's why you could have loss of function there and maybe not any real noticeable difference between the health of the people.
That's right, yeah. So it might actually still play a role in how people differ from one another, but these ones probably don't have a big impact on disease. And we looked pretty hard at these. We couldn't really find much evidence that these common loss-of-function variants played a big role in disease. Mm-hmm. It was really only when we got to the rare end of the spectrum, and this is actually the majority of the variants in our sample, turned out to be very rare, many of them with a frequency of less than 1%. So we think loss-of-function variants tend to be more rare than other classes of variation in the genome, because many of them are either mild or severely deleterious, so they probably have some effect on disease risk. And that means natural selection keeps them at a low frequency in the population. They're not allowed to kind of bump up in frequency and affect lots of people. That fits with the fact we found about 50 of these really rare variants were actually either known or very likely to be involved in severe diseases like muscular dystrophy, for instance. These are all found in only one copy in our samples. For these diseases, you would normally need two copies to get the disease. We think these rare variants are the really interesting ones, so these are the ones we're pursuing the most heavily now. It's likely a pretty substantial number of these rare loss-of-function mutations will turn out to play some role in human disease, although we don't yet know exactly what disease these things will affect.
So what are the next steps for this research? You mentioned looking more closely at the rare variants to see if they had effects on disease, but what about the other proteins you've identified that you don't know the function of?
What we'd like to do over the next 3 years, we'll be taking the things that we've learned from this project and applying them in disease patients. The first step will be to roll together all the things that we've learned from this project into a single piece of software that anyone can use to analyze their own genome sequences from patients or from large cohorts, and look for loss-of-function variants and find them very accurately. And this will actually incorporate predictions of the probability that each loss-of-function variant affects gene function or disease risk. So that will be quite useful. For instance, if you're sequencing a patient with a disease, this will help you decide which of the 100 loss-of-function variants that person carries might actually be the one that is involved in their disease. Hmm.
Daniel MacArthur, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thanks very much.
Daniel MacArthur and colleagues write about loss-of-function variants in this week's Science.
This week, the Obama administration released its 2013 budget request. Our reporters were on top of the news as it unfolded, and Science Deputy News Editor Jeffrey Mervis spoke with me about what it might mean for scientific funding in the U.S.
What happened this week is the president requested money to support the entire federal government, including science. That means he asked Congress to spend a certain amount of money on each agency, on NIH, on NSF, on NASA.
And this is for the fiscal year 2013?
Right. This is for the fiscal year that starts in October. Right now, we're in 2012 fiscal year.
Okay, and so what we're looking at here, specifically with this story, is all sorts of research and development organizations and agencies. So we have the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation, defense research, energy research, all sorts of things. So what was the overall message from the government towards this kind of research and development?
Okay, well, you're right. The U.S. has a vast enterprise of research agencies, and the president has requested $140 billion this year in spending across those agencies. That's a 1% increase over what they currently get, which is pretty good in these tough budget times. Most agencies are getting cuts, and the science agencies did fairly well in that respect. But of course, the devil is in the details, as always. And so what's really important is to dive down below the overall number and look more closely at individual programs. That's the only way you can tell whether you, as an individual scientist in a particular area, have gotten favored or snubbed by the president.
That's right. It seems like it's really difficult to judge any particular winners or losers here. No one got any really great or really bad news. So let's delve into these details a little bit. Let's start with the Department of Energy. What was the outlook for them?
Well, the Department of Energy is one of the three agencies that this White House and the previous White House has singled out for a 10-year doubling path. They're a long way from reaching that starting in 2006. But every year, both Republican and Democratic presidents have called for an increase in the Office of Science. And this year is no exception. It's a $5 billion office. Within that office, though, there are six programs. And some of them, basic energy sciences, biological and environmental sciences, do well. Other programs, nuclear sciences and fusion, do not do well. In particular, there are some large facilities that DOE supports where those accelerators, in particular, are only going to be running a fraction of the amount of time that they could run because the government doesn't have enough money to keep them fully occupied. And for some projects in the wings, including a large new nuclear accelerator at Michigan State, they only got a small portion of what they were hoping to get to begin construction. So they're very concerned at Michigan State about whether the facility for rare isotope beams is ever going to be built at all.
Hmm. And now what about the National Institutes of Health?
Okay. Biomedical researchers are grumbling with this budget. For 7 or 8 years in a row, the presidents have requested basically flat funding. And that's in large part because earlier in the decade, NIH received the 5-year doubling, which makes it by far the largest federal research agency at about $30 billion. But because of inflation and because of the growth in the field and the opportunities, that doesn't allow scientists to do the research they'd like to do. But NIH is trying to make do with a flat budget. For example, they are promising to increase the number of new investigators that are getting grants for the first time by squeezing people who already have funding,
wow,
either by capping the amount that their grant will grow or by looking more closely at people with a large number of grants, mm-hmm, and saying, do you really need a fourth or fifth grant if you already have three? And they're hoping that way to take the same amount of money and reach more people, ultimately to reach more new ideas and make new discoveries.
Sounds like some pretty tough decisions.
Tough decisions. Now, that was almost the byword at NASA, because you have an agency there that does several things. About a third of its $18 billion budget goes to science, about a third goes to human exploration, and a third goes to aeronautics and other programs. And within the science missions, roughly $5 billion, there are some flagship programs, one of which is a program to visit Mars every 2 years with robotic missions and eventually scoop up dirt, analyze it, and then bring it back. NASA recently teamed up with the European Space Agency because neither agency had enough money to go it alone. But this year, the Obama administration has proposed cutting out NASA's participation in what's called ExoMars for 2016 and 2018. That could doom future Mars missions. The U.S. still has current missions. They have a mission that's going to be landing this summer that everyone's pretty excited about. But scientists are always looking ahead at the next opportunity. And right now, under the president's proposal, there aren't a lot of opportunities to go to and study Mars.
So those are the programs who got cuts in this budget request. Were there any who continue to get support?
Yes. The biggest program within this directorate is the James Webb Space Telescope. It is now a $8.8 billion project. It has gone over budget. It has gone behind schedule. Now NASA says it has a handle on it, but unfortunately it needs more money than it originally planned. And to make room for that, it looks like planetary programs were squeezed. But you have to remember, this is still a request. And if Congress doesn't like what the president has requested, it can change it.
Well, I think that this is all a good point, that this is only a budget request for right now. And as some of us may remember, in 2012, there was really a lot of back and forth. There was continuing resolution after continuing resolution. Are we likely to see this same budget climate again going into 2013?
In a word, yes. To be a little bit more specific, this is an election year, and the Republicans have no interest in giving the president any victories on the budget. At the same time, the president is running for re-election, and so he wants to take his case to the people. It's also an unusual year because this year, Congress and the White House have already agreed how much money they have to spend. That's usually the debate in Congress during the budget cycle. This year, they already know the bottom line. The fight will be over whether you're going to get there by increasing taxes, in other words, increasing revenues, as well as making cuts, which is what the White House and many Democrats want, or whether you're going to get there by reducing spending entirely, which is what most Republicans want. So that's where the fighting comes in, and that's where some observers have said the president ducked the issue. He's proposed increases in areas where he feels you need increases. He's made proposals for tax increases that no one expects to be approved, which means that government revenues will not be as high in all likelihood as the White House is estimating. If that's the case, then Congress will ultimately have to decide how much it wants to tighten the deficit and how much it wants to support ongoing programs, including the entire science budget, which is only a small portion of the overall federal budget.
Well, it'll be an exciting few months. Jeff Mervis, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Mervis and the news team give us an inside look at the president's 2013 budget request in a news article this week. You can find detailed coverage about the budget request on Science Now and Science Insider.
Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor of Science, with some of the recent stories from our daily news site. So, David, we have some animal stories today. First, a fish that can resist the teeth of piranhas.
Right. Sarah, this is a story about the arapaima, which is a fish that frequents the waters of the Amazon, and it's a very interesting fish. First of all, it's huge. It weighs up to 200 kilograms. It's about 2.5 meters long, and it's called a living fossil because it actually still has lungs, and it needs to come to the surface to breathe air. But what's most fascinating about this fish is that it can actually withstand a piranha attack. Fishermen who try to catch this thing actually throw chunks of meat into the water to get it to come to the surface. And the piranhas make quick work of this meat, but not quick work of the arapaima. And the question is, how does this fish survive such a deadly predator? Piranha's teeth are about as sharp as carving knives.
So there's some observations in nature. How did they test it in the lab?
Well, what they did was they actually looked at the arapaima's scales. They figured that's where its defense was coming from. And lo and behold, it has some pretty interesting scales. Its scales are silver and black shingles, which can grow up to 10 centimeters long. And when the researchers took a closer look, the scales are actually composed of some pretty interesting stuff. On the inside, they're made from sheets of collagen, which is this tough and springy material material that's found in our own joints and bones. Mm-hmm. So they kind of have this flexible material on the inside, but on the outside, they're actually made from collagen again, but the collagen is cemented together with calcium, which is a much tougher material. Mm-hmm. It's the kind of material found in our bones. So this combination of the really tough exterior helps the fish withstand the bite of the piranha. And the fact that they're flexible on the inside means that when piranha bite them with these carving knife teeth, it doesn't shatter the scales because they've got this flexibility. So it's a really sort of nice, flexible, but tough armor that these fish have.
So what kinds of applications are people looking into for this kind of armor?
Well, researchers would obviously like to use this, Sarah, to develop lightweight body armor. You could think about armor that's sort of tough on the outside, flexible on the inside, and that would allow people to move around but still be protected from things like knives. And I'm not sure bullets, would they be protected from bullets with this stuff? But who knows? You know, scientists are always trying to find ways to take some fascinating stuff in the wild and apply it to stuff we could use every day.
Like swimsuits.
That too.
Okay. So next we have another animal story. The mystery of why zebras are striped.
Exactly. This is a mystery that actually goes back more than 120 years. Scientists have been pondering why zebras have these unusual stripe-like patterns. And there's been a few hypotheses floating around. One is that the pattern somehow confuses predators. Another one is that it helps the zebras camouflage themselves in grasslands. Another one is that the patterns are actually unique to each zebra and therefore helps the animals pick each other out in large herds. But none of these hypotheses have actually been experimentally tested. And there's actually one other hypothesis that hasn't been tested either, and it's the idea that the patterns actually repel some pretty nasty flies out there on the African grasslands, tsetse flies and horse flies, which are pretty notorious pests in humans. They transmit illnesses like sleeping sickness and Chagas disease. So these are pretty nasty things, and the idea would be, well, maybe there's something about the zebra's pattern that repels these insects. But again, that is something that hadn't been experimentally tested either.
All right, I'm going to ask it. How did they test what flies like about stripes or don't like about stripes?
Well, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, they actually didn't test this on real zebras. They actually made some zebra models. And you can actually take a look at these guys on the site. What they did was they created these fake horses that had a variety of coat patterns. Some had dark colored, some had plain white coats, and others had striped coats, kind of like you'd see on a typical zebra, and actually coated these models with glue to trap any insect that would alight on them. And again, they were looking specifically at horse flies and tsetse flies. What they found was that the flies seemed to prefer the solid patterns. They seemed to prefer the solid white, solid brown patterns, and they were not as crazy about the more zebra-like patterns.
And why do the researchers think that they had a preference?
Well, they knew going in that horse flies seem to prefer darker solid patterns because they reflect a type of light called polarized light, which is basically all the light waves are oriented in the same direction. And the reason they think the flies prefer this pattern is because water also reflects this kind of pattern. Yeah. And these flies want to gravitate to water because that's where they lay their eggs. It was also known that the pure white pattern doesn't reflect this type of polarized light. So it was interesting that the flies in the experiment still preferred the pure white pattern over the zebra pattern. And the reason they think is because the zebra pattern is even more of a disrupted pattern. Mm-hmm. It's even more sort of foreign to these flies, even more far away than the kind of pattern that would be reflected from a pool of water. So if the flies have to choose between a solid pattern and a stripe pattern, they're always going to go for the solid pattern, at least according to this study.
Really interesting.
Really interesting.
Well, next up, we have a fascinating study about deep brain stimulation. My first question, where do you find volunteers for this?
Well, maybe your first question, Sarah, should be, what is deep brain stimulation? And actually, it's kind of what it sounds like. It's actually stimulating the brain with bursts of electricity. Now, this actually doesn't sound like a lot of fun, but researchers have actually done this in rats for a few years, and they found that by stimulating the brain with little electric shocks, they can improve memory, they can sort of improve other brain processes. And the question does the same thing happen in humans? And to get to your first question, why would people want their brains zapped with electricity, or even how would you do this? The researchers in the study actually took advantage of some patients in the hospital. They actually already had wires going into their brain to help mitigate their seizures. So they were already part of a study to look for ways to use electricity or zaps to the brain to help control seizures. And the researchers said, well, let's piggyback on this and let's see, now that these patients are already wired up, can we use deep brain stimulation to improve memory?
And what kinds of memories were they looking to improve?
Well, they had the volunteers play this video game where they were pretending to be a taxi cab driver, and they drove all around this virtual city using this joystick, and they had to pick up passengers and drop them off at various locations. And part of the challenge of the game was remembering the routes and the quickest way from point A to point B. And what the researchers did with some of the patients is when they figured out a good route or a very quick route, they would zap their brain with electricity, and they wanted to see the next time they had to drive some between place A and place B, would they remember that route quicker if their brains had been zapped?
Well, so they directed this zapping at different parts of the brain. It wasn't just one specific part?
Exactly. They focused on a couple of places in the brain. One was called the entorhinal cortex, which is a part of the brain's memory circuitry. And another one was the hippocampus, which has been found to be crucial for memory. So both of these things should enhance memory if zapped, at least you would think. But what the researchers found was that indeed when they zapped the entorhinal cortex, the volunteers actually remembered their routes a lot better the second time around. So if they found a good route in this virtual city and their brains were zapped in the entorhinal cortex, they were much quicker, much more quick to run that route a second time. But when they were zapped in the hippocampus, the same thing didn't happen. They didn't really show a lot of improvement in finding these quick routes through the city.
Well, this sounds like a pretty serious procedure, but it might have applications for Alzheimer's?
Exactly. I mean, this isn't the kind of thing that you'd want to sign up for tomorrow to improve your memory. First of all, it's a very preliminary study. But what researchers are saying is, memory aside, there has been some hints that deep brain stimulation can improve things like symptoms of Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease, or even possibly treat depression and other psychiatric disorders. So this new study lends credence to the fact that, as strange as it may seem, zapping the brain with electricity may have a lot of positive benefits.
It'll be really interesting to see how that turns out. So we have some exciting travel plans coming up. We're both going to AAAS. What are you going to be doing while we're out there?
Right, Sarah. Well, we're both going to be in Vancouver, and our daily news team is going to be covering a lot of the breaking news that's happening at the AAAS meeting. There's really exciting sessions happening every day, so be sure to check out the website for the latest and the greatest. We'll also be running a few Science Live chats from the meeting. We've got a chat on dying languages, a chat on alien life at the bottom of the sea, and also a chat about the future of the world's oceans. So be sure to check out all of our coverage on that. And in the meantime, we're running a lot of budget stories on Science Insider. President Obama announced his budget request for 2013 this week, and we've got a lot of stories about the impact his request could have on agencies like the National Institutes of Health, the impact it could have on AIDS research, and even the impact it could have on the development of the next generation of supercomputers. So be sure to check out all of this stuff on the site.
Thank you so much, David.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the online news editor for Science. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the February 17th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.